riding with him around town, but never on the expressway. He bought her a bodysuit of leather and Kevlar, protective boots and gloves, and a state-of-the-art helmet, but still she refused to hop on the seat behind him and flirt with death on the virtually deserted I-75 after midnight. Until it was time to leave their house. The night the bank came.
Reuben, they're taking the car!
The house was empty, and they'd been ordered out by midnight. The front door was wide open, and Savannah was watching the men in the driveway. The repo team moved quickly. Reuben went to the gym bag on the floor. In it was his pistol collection, and he would go down shooting before turning that over to the bank. He zipped it open and grabbed a Glock. They're not taking another fucking thing.
Stop! She shouted. They can't have it! It's a stupid car!
Reuben gripped his pistol. He'd been pushed too far, but there was a reasoning part of him that understood she was right. It's not worth going to jail over this, she said. No, she was definitely right. If he was going to risk jail, it would be for something big, big enough to make the bank regret the day they'd messed with Reuben Betancourt. He stood in the doorway and watched the repo men back their car out the driveway, then the orange taillights disappearing into the night. Let's go, he said. The car was gone, but they still had wheels. Reuben had already lost ownership of his restaurant, and Savannah had offered up her jewelry before letting him cash out his beloved motorcycle in their losing battle to stay afloat. The Kawasaki was next door in the garage. Their neighbors had been foreclosed on the month before, the 13th in the neighborhood, and the house was empty. They waited in the garage until 1 a.m. to make sure the repo men were out of the neighborhood, no one watching. Savannah's girlfriend in Broward had said they could stay with her for a few nights. Reuben strapped their bags to the motorcycle. Helmets on, they were off. The expressway was theirs for the taking, but Reuben watched his speed. This was Savannah's first time on the interstate. He hadn't invested in microphones for the helmet, so they'd worked out a system. A tug at his right elbow if she needed him to slow down. 20 minutes of smooth riding just below the speed limit. No signal from Savannah. He bumped it up to 70. Still good. Then something overtook him. Reuben couldn't get the repo men out of his mind, the feeling of powerlessness as he'd watched them drive away in his car. He needed to grab back the power. Steadily, he increased velocity. The G-forces mounted. So did his anger. Savannah tightened her hold around his waist, but he felt no tug at his elbow. He checked the speedometer. 95 and rising. At this speed, with each upward tick, the increase in vibration, wind, and engine roar was on an order of magnitude. He was beginning to feel like a man again, not that poor, impotent bastard whose financial carcass could be picked clean by some vulture in a pinstripe suit. At 98, he felt it. Savannah tugged his elbow. They were so close. He had to break 100. She tugged harder. Just another second was all he needed. She jerked his arm so hard that she nearly sent them into a spin. Her doctor would later explain the phenomenon to Reuben. It was the same sensation some people get when they walk too close to the edge of a balcony and feel like they're going to jump. Savannah had felt that terrifying sensation and couldn't control it. She'd tugged and pulled at his arm and had to get off that bike. Reuben cut the speed from 90 to 70 to 60, but she tugged even harder. They were down to 50 or so when she just couldn't stand it anymore. She let go.
Savannah!
Reuben felt the vibration of the engine, felt in control of the beast as the motorcycle sped down the expressway in the afternoon sun. The leather and Kevlar suit had saved Savannah's skin, literally, and the full-face helmet had prevented catastrophe. Had she managed to stay in a smooth slide like the professional racers, she might have been unhurt. But she'd extended her arm, trying to stop herself, which only sent her body into a tumble over and over again. She spent weeks in the hospital. Left arm broken in three places, a fractured pelvis that lacerated her appendix. The appendix turned out to be the real disaster. The resulting infection had spread to places it should never have spread. The pain lasted for months, but the real loss was something Reuben could never make up to her, though he would try. Whatever Savannah wants, Savannah gets. Except for the one thing she could never have. A child. Reuben exited the expressway and drove toward one of the huge landscape nurseries that sprouted from the fertile soil along the Everglades border. The pavement gave way to a gravel road and dust kicked up behind him. 50 acres of mature palm trees lay before him. He was less than a mile from I-75, but it was legitimately the middle of nowhere. Here, even the most inept insurance fraudsters avoided detection, flocking to irrigation canals in broad daylight, dumping an overpriced vehicle in 8 feet of opaque water, and then reporting it stolen. Reuben parked his motorcycle in the grass at the edge of the canal, opened the storage compartment, and removed his Glock. For 2 years, he'd been promising Savannah that he'd get rid of the motorcycle. Selling it would have gained him nothing, since the bank that had foreclosed on their house held a judgment lien on his bike. More to the point, a sale would have done nothing to slay his demons. He reached below the frame and scratched out the motorcycle's vehicle identification number with his key. Then he walked to the middle of the road. Neat rows of countless trees, palms of every variety, stood between him and the interstate. Even though he couldn't see beyond the nursery, he was roughly dead even with the spot where Savannah had jumped. He turned to face his Kawasaki, raised his pistol, and took careful aim at the gas tank. He squeezed off one shot. A direct hit, but there was no fire, no explosion. The puncture hole did its job, however, spilling gasoline all over. Reuben changed out the standard 9mm clip for military-issue tracer ammunition, the other clip he'd packed just for this purpose. Some marksmen like to follow the trajectory of a bullet in target practice, and tracers had just enough powder outside the casing to emit a visible white light, and just enough spark to ignite gasoline. Reuben squeezed off a second shot, and the Kawasaki burst into flames. He watched from a distance. It had taken him 3 years to save up for that machine, but he'd been planning this moment since the accident. His old biker friends might have seen it as wasteful, but Reuben had enough money now to buy hundreds of motorcycles, if he wanted them. But he didn't. He wanted only one thing. The thing that the bank and this motorcycle had taken away. The fire burned hot for several minutes, and when it was down to almost nothing, Reuben walked back toward his bike. A quick kick to the frame toppled the charred remains. What was left of his Kawasaki tumbled down the steep embankment and into the black canal. The hot metal sizzled, and it sank to the bottom, gone. Forever. Civilization was a mile up the road. Reuben dialed a cab on his cell, told the driver to meet him in 20 minutes at the only gas station around, and started walking. What Savannah wants, Savannah gets. Reuben just needed to figure out how money could buy it back. Chapter 16. The severed finger came through for the FBI.
We got a DNA match, Andy said. She was with Littleford in his office on the second floor.
CODIS does it again? He asked.
The Combined DNA Index System, CODIS, is an FBI-funded computer system that stores DNA in searchable profiles for identification purposes.
Convicted felons are in the database.
Yup, she said as she laid the report in front of him.
Marco Arroyo, she said. 41 years old, lengthy criminal record. 6 years in prison for Grand Theft Auto.
Does he steal delivery trucks used in getaways?
I'd like to find out.
Where does he live?
Sand Dunes Apartments in West Miami. Also happens to work at a ceramic tile warehouse less than a mile from the airport.
Littleford smiled. Now we're on to something. I'll take the apartment. You check out the warehouse.
Andy coordinated with Lieutenant Watts at MDPD while driving to Miami Tile and Marble in the warehouse district near the airport. On the off chance that Marco was still alive and had actually shown up for work minus a finger, she wanted backup. It was just before 2 p.m. when she pulled into the parking lot. The roar of jet engines in the air made her feel even closer to the airport than she was. A 747 passed almost directly overhead on approach to the runway. Andy glanced up and wondered how many millions were in the cargo belly. Watts met her outside the warehouse, and together they went inside to the manager's office. The manager was on the phone. Andy was able to catch his eye through the little window in the door, mostly because a good-looking woman was an unexpected sight in this mostly male environment. A flash of her badge got his full attention. He ended the call and stepped out to meet her in the busy warehouse area. Andy and Lieutenant Watts introduced themselves.
Mahoney, he said, reciprocating. Todd Mahoney.
They shook hands, and the calluses confirmed Andy's first impression that he'd worked his way up from the warehouse to the front office. Mahoney looked out of place in a necktie, and he wore the short-sleeved dress shirt of a blue-collar man only half-committed to management. He was middle-aged and overweight, but he had the tough, stocky look of a guy who could move a full pallet of ceramic tile without a forklift.
We're here about Marco Arroyo, said Andy.
A forklift beeped behind them. It was backing up with a 2-ton pallet of marble tiles in its load. Mahoney pulled Andy out of the way.
Good luck, said Mahoney.
Haven't seen Marco in over a week. Hired a replacement for him this morning. He didn't even pick up his last paycheck.
Have you checked with his family?
Marco's a piece of shit. He's got no family.
That explained the absence of a missing persons report.
What kind of guy was he? Asked Andy.
Rhodes Scholar. Sang in the Vienna Boys Choir. Just like all the knuckleheads here.
The forklift was beeping and coming at them even faster than before. Mahoney pulled Andy out of the way again.
Hey, moron!
He shouted at the driver.
Can you do your job someplace where no one will get killed?
The driver shrugged as if to say, my bad, and moved to a different stack of tiles. Mahoney looked at Andy and said,
that's what Marco was like.
Did you know he was a convicted felon? Asked Andy.
He mentioned it, yeah. I take what I can get.
I'm sure you've heard about the Lufthansa heist from MIA 8 days ago.
He smiled a little, almost wistfully, which Andy was finding to be a common reaction. To the average Joe, there was an odd Bonnie and Clyde-like romanticism about making off with millions in the back of a pickup truck.
Yeah, said Mahoney. That's not far from here.
Marco is a person of interest in the heist.
Marco? You shitting me.
Why does that surprise you?
Mahoney looked across the warehouse, stared down a couple of goofballs who were slacking off, then answered,
from what I heard on the news, that was close to $10 million. hard for me to think of Marco the millionaire. Kind of funny, actually.
I don't think Marco's laughing, said Andy. We have reason to believe he's severely injured, could even be dead. We need to find him.
His expression changed, as if he suddenly recalled that things hadn't ended so well for Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty on the silver screen.
Like I said, haven't seen him.
Was your warehouse open on the Sunday of the heist?
No, we're never open on Sundays, he said.
But then a light seemed to go on.
But Marco was here.
How do you know?
2 months ago, right around Labor Day, he said he needed extra hours. He asked if he could be the security guard on Sundays. We've had some problems with theft on weekends, so I said okay.
He was here by himself?
As far as I know.
Do you have any security cameras that might have caught any activity on that afternoon?
Seriously? Here? The last warehouse in this area to install security cameras had them stolen.
Did you notice anything unusual here when you came to work Monday morning?
Mahoney shook his head.
Nope.
Two vehicles are of special interest. She described the pickup and showed him a photograph of the delivery truck.
Again, he shook his head.
Detective Watts jumped in.
Do you mind if I look around a little?
Be my guest, said Mahoney.
I really got to get back to work.
1 second, said Andy. Do you know anything about Marco's friends? People he hung out with?
Marco didn't have any friends here. He kept to himself. But there was this one guy who used to drive him to work every now and then. They'd meet for lunch sometimes, too. In fact, he stopped by here earlier this week looking for Marco.
Andy reached for her notepad. You know his name?
Mahoney scratched his head, thinking.
Marco used to call him Pinky.
Does he wear pinky rings?
I asked Marco the same thing. He got the name in prison. Communal showers, no privacy. Supposedly he's got a dick down to his knees, so they started calling him Pinky as a joke. Like calling a tall guy Shorty.
Andy didn't write that in her notes.
Anything else you remember about him?
No, I really couldn't even tell you what he looks like. Just the pinky thing sticks out. No pun intended.
Not much to go on, said Andy. Unless he's hiding out in a nudist colony.
Wish I could be more help, said Mahoney.
Andy put away her notepad, empty.
So do I.
Chapter 17.
Jeffrey's eyes blinked open, but only for an instant. It hurt too much to open his right eye, so he used only his left. The light was annoying, but slowly, the strange room came into focus. He was on his back, lying on a floor of cool, unfinished concrete. A bare bulb hung by a wire from the ceiling. He pushed himself up and wanted to stand, but he could only rise to a seated position. His wrists and ankles were chained to an exposed metal stud in the wall. There was enough slack to move no more than a couple of feet in any direction, left, right, or upright. The chains rattled as he lowered himself back to the floor.
Whoa! Head rush!
That simple up-and-down motion stirred the fog in his brain, reminding him why his right eye hurt so much. He could feel the swelling. He could almost feel that boot again, the steel-toed battering ram that had rearranged his face. His pleas for mercy, "Stop, stop, I'm begging you," had been useless. The night was coming back to him now. Staggering out of the gold rush and into the parking lot, someone grabbing him from behind, the sharp blow to the back of his head, and some guy cursing the fat son of a bitch as they shoved him into the trunk of his own car. Jeffrey had offered them money on the spot, but the lid slammed shut and off they went. not far. A few minutes later, the car stopped, but he wasn't sure where they were when the trunk opened. The men didn't let him out. They handed him a phone and said, "Call someone who thinks you're worth your weight in gold, you fat fuck." He didn't want to get Savannah involved, so he tried his uncle. Pinky was absolutely no help. "You got yourself into this, you get yourself out." Only then did he phone his sister. He had no memory of what he'd said to her. He remembered someone snatching the phone away and slamming the trunk shut. The next ride was much longer. He was pressed against the spare tire, and it was hard to breathe. His belly was so big he couldn't even roll onto his side. He must have passed out at that point. The next thing he remembered, he was on the floor with his face pressed against the concrete. A garage? Yeah. Must be. His kidnappers must have pulled him out of the truck, dropped him on the floor, and chained him to one of the wall studs. He opened his left eye as wide as he could, and his gaze swept the garage in monovision. He spotted the tool bench along the wall, and his right thumb began to throb. The pain was rushing back to him. His memory was becoming clearer. He remembered the needle-nosed pliers, the angry voice of one sadistic bastard, and the laughter from his buddies who were looking on. "Where's the money, Jeffrey? Where's your fucking money?" It made him cringe just to think about it, and the sound of his own screams replayed in his mind. He tried to sit up again, then stopped. He heard footsteps outside. Someone was coming. He listened carefully. Just one set of footsteps was all he could discern. "Please God, not the maniac with the pliers." The door opened. Not the big garage door, but the side door. Jeffrey caught his breath, sat up, and did a double take. He recognized that beautiful face. He knew that perfect body, even with clothes on. It was Bambi from the Gold Rush. She came to him and knelt at his side. "Oh my God, Jeffy, are you okay?"
"No.
Look at my thumb. They ripped out the nail."
"Oh, you poor, poor thing."
He tried not to get emotional, but his lower lip began to quiver, and he couldn't help himself. The sweet sound of her voice was too much. He started crying, a little at first, then uncontrollably. "Oh, honey," she said, as she cradled his head against her bosom. "Don't cry." He pulled himself together.
"Can you get me out of here?
Please."
She changed her tone, not harsh, but firm.
"I can't do that, Jeffy."
He sniffled.
"Why?"
"Only you can get you out of here."
He looked around, puzzled.
"I'm chained up. I can't do anything."
"These are really bad guys you're up against, Jeffy. But they're not unreasonable. They know you have money."
"I don't. I really don't. I burned through all of it. Every cent is gone."
"They don't believe you."
"It's true."
"They think there's more stashed somewhere."
He didn't answer. She stroked his chin, forcing him to look her in the eye.
"Does your brother-in-law have more?" she asked.
He was silent.
"I want to help you," she said. "But you have to be honest with these men. You have to tell them how much money you have."
"I told you! I'm broke!"
"I don't mean just you. I mean the whole family, Jeffy. Did your family come into some money?"
He looked down at the floor, but she gently tucked his chin again, forcing him to look at her through his one good eye.
Such a sweet face.
Uh-huh. A lot of money?
She asked.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
He hesitated, and for an instant, he was tempted to answer. But finally, he shook his head.
I can't. I can't tell anyone.
She moved a little closer, pressing more of her hard body against his flabby torso.
You can tell me. It will be our secret.
If I tell you, everyone will be mad at me.
No, they won't, Jeffy. They're your family. Look at you,
she said as she cupped his face gently with her hands.
So cute.
The only way they will be mad at you is if you don't do everything in your power to make these mean, mean men stop beating on your precious head. You want them to stop, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I really do.
How much can you pay, Jeffy? Whisper it in my ear.
She nuzzled against him, letting a wisp of hair brush his face. The smell pushed him over the edge. It was Bambi's trick to finger herself and then wear her own scent on her neck the way other women wore perfume.
400,000, he whispered. That's all of it.
She kissed him on the forehead.
That's my boy. So smart. So, so smart. You'll be back where you belong in no time. Now tell me where all that money is.
He struggled. No way did he want to drag his mother into this.
I can't tell you.
Jeffy, you can tell me anything.
No.
Please, Jeff, I said no!
It had startled both of them. Jeffrey had never said no to her, much less with an edge. She pulled away from him and shot an icy glare.
You disappoint me.
I just can't tell you that.
Fine. Be that way.
I'm sorry.
She rose and stood over him, looking down as if he were a pile of something she just stepped in.
It's too late to apologize,
Jeff, she said, emphasizing that he was no longer Jeffy.
No, I really am sorry.
Save it. You had your chance. You don't have to tell me where it is. You can tell them. A shiver went down his spine. He wanted to fix things, but his mind was a blank, and he couldn't find words. He watched in silence as she walked away, and the door slammed on her way out. Chapter 18. Reuben picked up Savannah from work at 7. He didn't take the usual route home, but Savannah was either too tired or too distracted to notice until they were on the turnpike.
Where are we going?
She asked. It's a surprise, he said.
I've had enough surprises for one day, thank you.
This is a good thing. You'll like it.
She looked out the passenger window. A sea of Miami suburbia twinkled beneath the purple-black night.
Whatever.
Definitely tired. The speed ripples in the road sent a vibration through the car. They were approaching the prepaid toll lanes. Reuben steered with one hand while holding a transponder against the windshield so that the electronic eye could read it. Reuben was one of the last remaining drivers in Miami who still owned one of those clunky old transponders that attached to the window with suction cups, and the cups were shot.
I know I told you not to spend any money, she said, but I really think we can afford a new gizmo.
Not if we have to keep digging your brother out of trouble.
You shouldn't have helped him hide the money. We should have just gone to the police and begged for mercy.
We can't go back now. She breathed in and out, looking out the window again.
I'm just so worried about him.
Reuben reached across the console and squeezed her hand. Everything is going to work out. Ramsey will get him back. He promised me he would.
You talk like this Ramsey is Spider-Man or something. What if these are the same guys who cut off that man's finger in the delivery truck?
These aren't the same guys. These are small-time punks.
How do you know?
He glanced over. She was a bundle of nerves. He had to put her at ease, and this time nothing short of the truth would do it. The guys who kidnapped your brother are friends of Ramsey.
You told me he wasn't in on it.
He's not. He hesitated, not sure how it was going to sound, but he said it anyway. I hired Ramsey to scare Jeffrey.
Excuse me, she said.
It was that accusatory tone, not at all a question. Jeffrey was out of control. He wouldn't listen to anyone. I asked Ramsey to put a scare into him so that he'd stop flashing money.
So he's not really kidnapped?
Well, he is, actually. It backfired. Ramsey asked his friends to meet up with Jeffrey in the parking lot outside the Gold Rush to scare him. But your brother is such a marshmallow that he started offering them money before they even laid a hand on him, before they even asked for a dime. So they grabbed him and now they want some serious money. It's just a mess. But it's not the same guys who kidnapped Marco. It can't be.
Reuben, what on earth were you thinking?
It'll be fixed.
Yeah, and we have to fix it. Jeffrey got kidnapped because your plan backfired.
Don't worry, I've got another plan. Another sigh from Savannah. She wasn't happy.
This changes everything.
I mean, yes, Jeffrey stole some money, a lot of money, but he didn't hurt anybody. Now, he could be killed, and it's our fault.
Reuben changed lanes and steered toward the turnpike exit. He fumbled again for the clunky transponder as they passed the electronic toll booth.
Where are we going?
She asked. The perfect change of subject. Close your eyes.
Reuben, I am not in the mood for surprises. I'm trying to help you.
If you want to feel better, play along for 2 minutes.
Oh, all right, she said, groaning.
They were passing Miami-Dade County's other airport, Candle-Tamiami Executive, a smaller general aviation facility that served mostly light single-engine propeller planes. It was right across the street from several residential communities. Reuben made sure Savannah kept her eyes closed as he steered onto Country Walk. He drove past several one- and two-story houses, then stopped at the end of the cul-de-sac.
Okay,
he said. You can open your eyes. It was dark, but there were enough street lamps and porch lights for Savannah to recognize the neighborhood. It looked pretty much the way it had before the banks had foreclosed and taken over 8 of the 10 houses on the street.
It's our old house, she said.
Wrong. It's our new house.
What?
I bought it back.
Her mouth fell open, and it took her a moment to form words.
Why would you do that?
I want you to be happy.
This doesn't make me happy.
You cried when we lost this house.
I'm over it.
Come on, he said.
Get out for 1 second and check out the curb appeal.
Curb appeal? Who have you been hanging out with, those sharks on that real estate reality show?
Just take a look. You'll fall in love again.
Reuben, no! You just bought a house? With stolen money?
No, it's not what you think. Do not lie to me.
Where else would you come up with the money for a house?
It's not a done deal, okay? But I just want you to see how easy this could be.
How easy what could be?
All this money.
Stop!
No, listen to me.
This goes on every day in South Florida. The only person who knows I'm involved is my real estate agent.
We put down a non-refundable cash deposit, no names involved. We don't close for another 120 days after it's safe for us to start spending money. Until then, the seller doesn't even know who the buyer is. This is insane, Reuben. It's not our money.
Fuck the bank, Savannah. They ruined us.
You need to get control of yourself right now. We agreed not to touch any of the money that you buried, not to get me a birthday present, not even to pay Jeffrey's ransom.
And now, you want to buy a house?
Not a house. Our home.
No. It's not ours. We can't go back to where we were.
Yes, yes, we can.
No. This ginormous house was when we were talking about 4 kids, 2 dogs, and
we can have all that.
No, we can't.
Reuben, you can't buy back what's lost. His cell rang. He checked the number. It was from the Gold Rush. This could be Ramsey, he told Savannah. He took the call. It was.
Mon, you got to come up with the money fast.
He was talking very quickly, almost breathless.
Slow down, said Reuben.
Start at the beginning. What's the deal?
The deal is they're gonna kill your brother-in-law if you don't pay up.
I told you, I'm not paying $1 million.
They don't want $1 million no more. They want 400,000.
Reuben froze. It was the exact amount he'd found under Jeffrey's mattress.
They're bluffing, he said.
No, no. They ain't bluffing. They know Jeffrey got 400,000, and they know it's in your mother-in-law's house. They're gonna break into the house and take it, Mon, if you don't give it to them.
Reuben's head was starting to spin. He covered the phone, looked at Savannah, and said, Jeffrey talked. He told them, the money is in your mother's house.
Oh, no,
she said. He spoke into the phone.
I'll give them 50,000.
Savannah grabbed him, her eyes wide with anger and fright. Reuben waved her off, but Ramsey was equally shocked.
You crazy, Mon. 50,000.
Just see if they'll take it.
They ain't gonna negotiate, Mon. Let me send you the video.
What video?
You'll see what I'm talking about. You check your text message in 1 minute, and you call me back at this number.
Ramsey hung up. Reuben waited with his cell in hand.
What did he say?
Asked Savannah. Hold on. His phone chimed with an incoming text. There was no written message, just a video. He tapped to open it, and Jeffrey's face filled the screen. Reuben caught his breath.
What is it?
Asked Savannah. The video streamed without audio for several seconds, starting with an overview of Jeffrey's swollen and bruised face. It looked as if someone had used him as a punching bag. Then it zoomed in, a close-up of complete terror. One more zoom, this time to his mouth, which was forced open with a tool of some sort. Needle-nose pliers. The audio kicked in, and Jeffrey's scream cut through the silence in their dark car.
Oh, my God!
Savannah shouted as she covered her ears. Reuben shut it off and tried to tuck his phone away. Savannah grabbed his hand and began prying it from his fingers.
What is it?
Leave it, he said. You don't want to see. Tears filled her eyes, but she kept tugging at his hand, trying to get his phone.
What did they do to Jeffrey?
Savannah, just calm down.
I can't calm down. Did they kill him?
No, he's not dead.
What did they do?
Reuben squeezed the phone in his fist even more tightly. No answer for her. Savannah slugged him in the shoulder.
Tell me what they did to my brother!
There was no way to sugarcoat it. They took his gold caps, he said, then added the worst of it, and some teeth with them. She screamed almost as loud as Jeffrey had, then buried her face in her hands, crying. Reuben reached over and laid his hand on the small of her back, but there was no time to console her. His phone rang. It was Ramsey.
You see that, Reuben? You see?
Yes, I saw.
You got to pay up. You got to give them what they ask for.
He glanced at Savannah, who was glaring right back at him. Okay, he said. He was speaking into the phone, but it was for Savannah's benefit as well. We'll pay them what they asked for. Ramsey was so relieved that the line crackled with a sigh.
Very smart, man. You give them what they ask for. This ends better for everyone.
You call them right now and tell them the exchange is tonight, said Reuben. I'll meet you at the Gold Rush in 1 hour. Ramsey agreed and hung up. Reuben looked at his wife. It's taken care of, he said in his most reassuring tone.
Pay the ransom,
she said, her voice shaking. I will.
Pay the ransom,
she said, her fear turning to anger.
And put this stupid house out of your head. This is going too far.
Listen to me, Reuben, or I swear.
I will leave you.
Their eyes met for a few seconds, but it seemed much longer. Never, not in all they had been through, had Savannah threatened to leave him. He looked past her toward the 5-bedroom house in the front yard that was just the right size for a pair of soccer goals. Then he turned the key and started the car. All right, he said. It's done. Chapter 19. Reuben drove home faster than he should have. Any run-in with the law was to be avoided, even a speeding ticket, but he got away with it this time. He parked in the driveway and tried not to draw comparisons between the dream house in Kendall and the shitty shoebox of a rental that he and Savannah had called home since the foreclosure. He grabbed a shovel from the garage, walked around to the patio behind the house, and started digging. Savannah checked on him as he was putting the pavers back into place. The sealed 8-inch PVC pipe lay beside the shovel. You buried Jeffrey's money at our own house? She asked. Reuben didn't answer. He was nowhere near ready to confess that he was the one calling the shots when they'd divvied up the stolen money, that the cash under Jeffrey's mattress was only part of Jeffrey's take, and that Reuben had held back $500,000 to keep Jeffrey under his thumb. He just gathered up the PVC pipe and carried it to the garage. The only way to remove the cap from the end of the pipe was to cut it off. Nearly a dozen vacuum-sealed packs of cash spilled out of the tube when he finished sawing. Savannah brought a gym bag from the closet and he stuffed the money into it. Then he went inside the house and unlocked his gun cabinet.
Do you really need that? Asked Savannah.
He chose the MRI Baby Desert Eagle and 2 clips of 9mm Parabellum ammunition, 10 rounds apiece. His collection included handguns with even more firepower, but he loved the grip on the baby, and the Israelis knew how to make a reliable combat weapon. He tucked it into his belt.
No way am I going unarmed.
She didn't press it. He kissed her goodbye, told her to make sure to lock the door, and went to his car. She waved from the front window as if to say, good luck. He waved back, as if to say he'd need it, and drove away. He was on the Dolphin Expressway, halfway to the strip club, when Ramsey called in his cell.
No need to come to the Gold Rush, said Ramsey. Meet me at Dadeland Mall, in the parking lot on the West End, the one closest to the expressway. My friends say we do the exchange there.
I thought you said they weren't your friends.
Friends of friends, Mon. That's all.
Reuben harbored enough doubts to be glad he'd packed the baby eagle.
Okay, I'll meet you there.
Reuben exited the Dolphin, got on the Palmetto, and drove south. Dadeland Mall was one of the busiest shopping centers in Florida. A lot of locals avoided it, but everyone knew where it was, and South American tourists visited by the busload as part of organized vacation packages. Parking was never easy, but on a Monday night, an hour before closing, the western lot near the Saks Fifth Avenue anchor was a good choice for the exchange. It wouldn't be overly crowded, so business of any description could be done without witnesses. But there would be just enough innocent bystanders to prevent Reuben from pulling a gun. Reuben entered the parking lot from Kendall Drive and drove slowly past Saks. He wasn't sure where to go exactly. A text message from Ramsey filled in the blank. Park at the end of row 11. The lot was about half full, with most vehicles parked closer to the building. He drove past them to the end of row 11 and stopped. He turned off the engine. Dadeland was in a safe suburban area, most people having no memory of the mall's bloody cocaine cowboy shootout of July 1979 that had reinforced Miami's brand as the most violent city in America. Still, Reuben wanted to be able to hear the footfalls of anyone who might approach, so he lowered the windows, which also eliminated the glare on the glass, giving him a clear view of the lighted parking lot. He took the gun from his belt and laid it between his legs on the seat, where he could grab it quickly. Then he waited. A minute later, he heard a knuckle rap on the passenger side panel. It was Ramsey's way of letting him know it was him, unnecessary as it was. There weren't many men with dreadlocks in the lot outside Saks. Ramsey opened the door and slid into the passenger seat.
You got the money, man?
Reuben handed him the gym bag. Ramsey opened it and peered inside at the vacuum-sealed plastic packs.
You bring me money or you bring me bacon, man?
There's exactly 400,000. The five packs of hundreds make 250. Six packs of 50s are 150. Count it if you want.
I trust you, man.
Ramsey dialed on his cell and reported to the kidnappers.
He brought it. It's all here.
Ramsey kept the phone to his ear, listening, but Reuben couldn't hear the other end of the conversation. Then he hung up and put his cell away. Where's Jeffrey? Asked Reuben.
He's coming right now, Ramsey said, pointing.
Reuben peered through the windshield toward the dark access road that ran along the other side of the chain-link fence. The road wasn't lit up like the parking lot, but even at a distance of 50 yards, there was no mistaking the 300-pound bowling ball staggering toward the entrance gate. Someone was at his side, and it appeared to be a woman.
Who's with him?
Asked Reuben.
She's one of the strippers from Gold Rush.
Is she in on this?
No, Ma, not her. Not me neither. We're just trying to help Jeffrey through this revolting situation.
Ramsey's favorite phrase. But this time it made Reuben want to reach for his pistol.
I'll give you a revolting situation.
What if I don't believe you?
Ramsey smiled. What you gonna do, man?
Call the cops.
It was the age-old conundrum. The reason criminals love to prey on other criminals. Reuben held his stare a moment longer, then returned his attention to Jeffrey and his escort. They were just reaching the gate, 50 feet away, still too deep in the darkness for Reuben to get a good look at the woman. Jeffrey suddenly seemed to recognize Reuben's car, which energized him. He broke free, no longer needing the help of his escort. She let him go, seeming to have no intention of getting any closer, where the lights of the parking lot might expose her. Adrenaline carried Jeffrey across the remaining ground. He yanked open the rear door, fell into the car, and slammed the door shut.
Oh, thank you, bro. Thank you. Thank you.
Jeffrey lay sprawled across the back seat. The dome light remained on, and Reuben looked over the seat to check out Jeffrey's condition. It wasn't as bad as the video, but his face was still a purple mess. Dried blood dotted his shirt. Jeffrey, smile for me. He forced the stupidest grin Reuben had ever seen. He still had his top teeth, enough to form words, but the bottom was a row of bloody nubs.
They laughed at me when they took my caps, he said.
Reuben felt a surge of anger. He grabbed a fistful of Ramsey's shirt collar.
Your friends didn't have to do this to him, he said, his voice hissing.
Easy, man.
You could have sneezed on him and Jeffrey would have given you whatever you wanted. It's not me, man. It's them. They're bad dudes, man. They like doing this shit.
The dome light blinked off. Jeffrey groaned in the darkness, his words barely audible.
I want to go home, Reuben. Take me home, please.
Reuben locked eyes with Ramsey, still gripping him by the collar.
Take him home, said Ramsey.
It was the first thing Reuben had heard all night that made any sense. He released his grip and started the engine. The Jamaican opened the passenger side door and Reuben nearly pushed him out onto the pavement. The car pulled away so quickly that the door slammed shut purely on the force of his acceleration. Jeffrey's groaning turned to deep, pathetic moans.
I want to go home.
Reuben speed dialed Savannah as he drove toward the parking lot exit.
I got him, he said into his cell.
Oh, thank God. Is he okay?
Another deep moan from the back seat only fed his anger. He'll be fine, he told her.
Are you okay?
I'm fine.
So you didn't need the gun after all?
Reuben chose his words carefully, thinking of Ramsey, his sadistic friends who like doing this shit, and this revolting situation. No, he said. I didn't need the gun. Not tonight. Chapter 20. Reuben drove straight home. Before heading to his mother-in-law's place and letting Beatrice see her son in this condition, he wanted Savannah to clean him up. But first, he laid down some ground rules.
Jeffrey, wake up.
Jeffrey was curled up in the back seat. Reuben shook him gently, trying to wake him.
Listen to me, said Reuben.
He grunted but seemed to be reasonably alert. Savannah has no idea I was part of the heist. She thinks it was just you, your uncle, and one of his friends.
You got that?
Uh-huh.
If you say anything to make her think I was part of this, you are going to wish the kidnappers had never let you go. Understand?
Yeah. Whatever you say, bro.
Good. Come on, Reuben said, pulling him from the seat.
Jeffrey was a complete load, absolutely no help in getting out of the car. His arms hung limply over Reuben's shoulders, and Reuben managed to pull him from the backseat piggyback style. Jeffrey would have fallen flat on his face in the driveway if he hadn't draped his body over Reuben's back. Reuben struggled to put one foot in front of the other, Jeffrey's feet dragging behind him like disc plows. Savannah hurried out to meet them in the driveway.
Oh, you poor boy. What did they do to your face?
Jeffrey grumbled something unintelligible, drooling on the back of Reuben's neck as he tried to speak.
We should take him to the emergency room, said Savannah.
Reuben could barely stand beneath the weight.
I need the emergency room.
The front steps were a challenge, but they finally got Jeffrey inside and laid him on the couch. His battered face looked even worse in the light. Savannah raided the medicine cabinet and brought out everything from painkillers to cotton balls. Reuben acted as his own chiropractor, arching and twisting his spine until it popped back into place. He watched from the armchair as Savannah tended to her brother's face.
Open your mouth, Jeffrey.
She dabbed his gums with a wet washcloth, but even a gentle touch made him scream.
Thank God it's just the bottom teeth, she said.
They only took the gold, said Reuben.
He needs a dentist.
They have really good ones in Thailand.
Cheap.
Please be serious.
I'm totally serious, said Reuben. That's where I'm sending him. Your mother, too.
Jeffrey told his kidnappers that his cash was in your mother's house. They both need to get out of Miami. Out of the country is even better.
We'll talk about that later.
She put two Tylenol in Jeffrey's mouth and told him to swallow.
Let's talk now, said Reuben.
We got a major problem. Don't forget that these guys started out asking for $1 million.
They settled for $400,000, but now they know Jeffrey's an easy mark. If we don't get him the hell out of Miami, they'll come back.
Savannah looked at her husband with concern.
What about you and me? Are we easy marks? What if they kidnap one of us?
Reuben caught his brother-in-law's eye, reminding him about the ground rules they'd established in the car.
What about it, Jeffrey? What'd you tell them about Savannah and me?
Nothing, bro. I told them the money was mine, nobody else's. They wanted to know who could find it, and I said, my uncle or my sister. That's it.
Good dog.
Reuben sat forward in his chair, his interrogation mode.
Did you tell them how you got your money?
I said I cashed in a lottery ticket.
That jibed with what El Padrino had told him at the Holy Santeria Church of Our Lady of the New Cadillac.
Did they believe you? Asked Savannah.
They didn't say they didn't, said Jeffrey.
It was a good try, said Reuben. But I'm pretty sure they know it didn't come from a lottery ticket.
Ramsey basically dared me to call the cops and report the kidnapping. He knows I can't, which means he knows that Jeffrey's money isn't legit.
That doesn't mean they know it's from the heist, Savannah said. What'd you tell Ramsey when you hired him to watch Jeffrey?
Jeffrey tried to sit up, but he was in too much pain.
What?
He asked, grimacing.
Hired?
Reuben shot his wife a look that said, shut it. Savannah shoved two more Tylenol in Jeffrey's mouth.
Here, baby. Take your medicine.
He spat out the pills.
What did you say about hiring Ramsey to watch me?
I misspoke, said Savannah.
No, I heard you.
The cat was out of the bag.